Good morning, everyone. My name is Francisco Panizza. I am the director of the Latin American Research Program of LSE Ideas and the convener of this conference. Welcome to the conference, and a very special thank you to our speakers and chairs for taking time out of their busy schedules to come to London and join us in this conversation. We have a long and exciting day of presentations and discussions in front of us, so I will be very brief. When the current crisis in the United States and the Eurozone unfolded, it struck me, as a specialist in Latin America, that I had seen it all before. Over the past quarter century, Latin America has had more than its fair share of financial crises, and perhaps because of it, it has learned from its own mistakes and has survived relatively unscathed the current crisis of the US and the Eurozone. Surely there are lessons to be learned, or so have thought some experts. Analysts soon began advertising an Argentine solution, or even a Uruguayan solution, to the Greek debt, perhaps without a full understanding of what these solutions imply. I guess that NATO would not be very happy if Greek battleships are impounded in some African port, as is happening to Argentina today. Current debates about austerity and growth resonate with similar debates in Latin America in the 1980s and in Asia in the 1990s. And yet, there is relatively little comparative analysis of financial crises across regional divides. It seems only natural that we are bringing together specialists in different regions of the world to consider not only the economic, but also the political dimensions of financial crisis. Tolstoy famously wrote that while happy families are all alike, every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way. Paraphrasing Tolstoy, it can be suggested that while countries get into crisis in similar ways, they get out of them in their own way. Arguably, the difference in how countries deal with crisis and how they get out of them has mainly to do with politics. So perhaps we can rename this conference the Politics of Unhappiness. This project has been a collaboration of several LSE Ideas programs. Founded in 2008, LSE Ideas is the Center for the Study of International Affairs, Diplomacy, and Strategy. It runs a series of regional and topical research programs on East and Southeast Asia, the Balkans, the Middle East, Latin America, Africa, as well as on transatlantic relations and on the history of the Cold War. In 2012, Ideas was named the world's fourth best university think tank by the Think Tanks and Civil Society Program of the University of Pennsylvania, which compared more than 5,300 think tanks from 120 countries. At the risk of this sounding like an acceptance speech of an award winner ceremony without having actually won anything, I would like to thank all the people and organizations that made this conference a reality. David Burns and the staff of Adam Delhaus that made available this beautiful venue. The directors and staff of LSE Ideas, Professors Michael Cox and Anne Westad, Emilia Knight, Tina Franulovic, Nuala Konolik, and Lena Polexic. The Latin American program interns, Isabel Diaz-Armas, Matthias Knepper, and Isabella Ricci, who have worked incredibly hard to bring us together today. A special thanks to Jorge Madrazo, the conference organizer. I think that a true sign of competence is making hard things look easy, and Jorge has done just that. Last but not least, it's only right that I also thank our sponsors, whose generous contributions made this conference possible. The LSE Annual Fund, the Department of Government of the LSE, and our individual sponsors, the Honorable Ross Kelly and Dr. David Morgan. Before I introduce the keynote speaker, a couple of thoughts. First, the event will be recorded and made available as a podcast. Details in the LSE Ideas website. Second, we know it will be a long day, so we'll be serving cake in our last coffee break to set the stage for the final roundtable discussion. So make sure you stick around. Now, it is my pleasure to introduce our conference keynote speaker, Mr. Martin Verwey, Deputy Director General for Economic and Financial Affairs of the European Commission. Mr. Verwey started his public career at the Dutch Minister of Finance in 1994. From 1994 to 1998, he worked as an economist on economic and monetary union affairs in the Foreign Financial Relations Department. After a brief stint at the Economic and Financial Strategy Department, he moved to Manila, where he worked for 3 years for the Asia Development Bank. On his return in 2002, he became head of the Export Credit Insurance Division, and 2 years later, he assumed the position of Deputy Director of Economic and Financial Strategy Department. He was nominated Director of Foreign Financial Relations in September 2007. In September 2011, he moved to Brussels to become Deputy Director General Economic and Financial Affairs of the European Commission. Mr. Verwey.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm very honored to be here and to have the opportunity to talk to you about a subject which I find very interesting. And that's the politics of the euro crisis. That I stand here today is in no way self-evident. I'm not a politician, nor am I a political scientist. I'm just a simple economist. But that said, working as a civil servant, first for the Dutch Ministry of Finance on the euro crisis, and later for the European Commission, I think I've had a rather unique opportunity to study, or at least to observe, the political dimension of this crisis from relatively close by. I will not try to offer you a general theory of crisis politics. I could not. But I would like to share with you some observations and thoughts based on my personal experience during this crisis. As an appetizer, I would like you to have a look at these pictures. And these are the European leaders of the Euro area countries in 2010. And I had to divide it in two, unfortunately, because there were too many to fit on one screen. And now I would like you to compare this with these pictures. And these are the leaders in 2012. And you can see some familiar faces, but not a lot. In fact, I believe it's 12 out of 17 of the leaders of the euro area countries have changed since the beginning of the crisis. And in most cases, this was actually related, directly related, indirectly or directly related to the crisis. And this offers a first indication of the importance, the political importance, the political dimension of this crisis. Another illustration of the political dimension of this crisis is you can get, if you compare the agendas of the European Council prior to 2008 with those after 2008. The items on the agenda, for example, in 2007 were energy, climate, foreign relation, number of institutional issues. There was very little about economics and finance. This changed dramatically, obviously, after 2008. If you look now to a typical agenda of the European Council or the Euro Summit, it's basically completely dominated by financial topics, financial and economic topics. Another illustration is the following. Prior to 2008, European leaders met on average 3 times a year. Since 2009, the average time they meet per year is 7 times, so it's more than a doubling. And if you add to that, at least for some leaders, the G20 summits, which also started after 2008, and you add to that the much increased frequency of the meetings of the Eurogroup ministers, you get an idea as to how important this subject has become in political terms. And I think one can say that whereas prior to 2008, certainly prior to maybe better prior to 2010, the euro was something for the ministers of finance and central bankers. But since 2010, it has moved very much to the center of the political debate in Europe, and it's basically affecting everybody. But what is more, for many European leaders, this has not been a happy experience at all. This is particularly true for leaders in vulnerable countries. None of them have politically survived. I should put one footnote on this. In Cyprus, still the old president, President Christofias, but he has already announced not to run for president in the next election. So come February, he will be out of office also. But also for leaders in other euro area countries, the political environment has been very challenging. Now here I can speak from personal experience that to get parliamentary support for all these support measures that have been taken has often been a gruesome undertaking, very, very, very difficult to achieve. And my central thesis is that the political complexity of the euro crisis has had an enormous impact on how this crisis has been handled, and seemingly irrational approaches become more understandable when taking into account the political economy aspects of this crisis. And I just want to make clear, I'm not trying to defend in any way the record of the political leaders, but I think it's important to understand the mechanics, the political mechanics that are at play, also to do better in the future. And I hope that with this talk, I can make a small contribution to this debate. Okay. Before I venture into that, I want to very briefly dwell on the economics of this crisis. I can do this relatively quickly. It's not the main cause of this talk. The countries most affected are well known. I'm going to focus on Spain, Greece, Portugal, and Ireland. I could have added Cyprus, but I didn't. These countries have something very important in common, and that is illustrated by chart number one. Chart number one illustrates the build-up of external debt. It does this by using national savings less investment, or equivalently the flow of assets less liabilities at the national level. All these countries have accumulated national debt. In marked contrast, the euro area as a whole has not. The flip side of national debt, obviously, is a weakening of the external position of countries. This must be true, because if a country can only consume or invest more than it produces if it can borrow from abroad. So if all these countries have been accumulating debt, national debt, is there also a common story for where the debt was accumulating? And the answer is actually no. In chart two, we break down the national data in chart one into its component sectors. And in Greece, it's very clear, it's a consistent story of the government building up too much debt. But if you look at other countries, the story is pretty different. In Spain, non-financial corporates in the private sector were accumulating debt very rapidly in 2005 to 2008 period. And that, in turn, became a problem for the banks, that had lent to the private sector, and then the government had to step in to support the banks. In Ireland, it has also been a problem of banks accumulating too much debt. And in Portugal, the picture is consistent with one of both the corporate and the public sectors building up debt. But again, they have one thing in common. Wherever the debt was built up, whether it was the private sector or the government sector, in the end, in this crisis, all debt migrated, or a lot of the debt migrated to the balance sheet of the public sector. And it is then when these very nasty financial fiscal feedback loops begin. And this is, I believe, one of the reasons why a simple downturn has turned into a real crisis of historical proportions. So how does this financial fiscal feedback loop work? It's essentially very simple. The governments step in to support the bank, that weakens the balance sheet of the government, that in turn weakens the banks, and basically for two reasons. Because market participants realize that the governments may not have sufficient power to support the banks in the future, so that is one. But secondly, stepping in by the government also means, and the deterioration of government finances also means that, governments have to cut back on other expenditures, so that hits the economy, and that in turn also hits the loan books of banks, and also that leads to a further deterioration of the situation in banks. So the main points to retain from this are the following. I would say, contrary to public perception, at least in many countries, the euro crisis with the possible exception of Greece, is not caused by lax budgetary policies. For most affected countries, the problems originate actually in the private sector. But wherever the debt has originated, as I've said before, in the end, it all ends up at the public balance sheet. And it is this very negative financial feedback loop which makes this crisis so hard to overcome and so deep. And it's actually also for this reason why I am a very strong supporter of making further progress towards the creation of a banking union, because this is actually this is what is needed to basically break this link between the financial sector and the government. Well, while the handling of this crisis may not have been faultless, it would not be right to conclude that no progress has been made. I think, in fact, a lot of progress has been made. And let me just give you a few examples to make this somewhat more concrete. First and foremost, reforms have been implemented and adjustment is taking place. On the fiscal side, the total euro area deficit was above 6% in 2010. We expect for 2012 that it will come out slightly above 3%, and we expect it to fall further, well below 3% in 2013. At the same time, we see clear improvements. We see clear improvements in competitiveness in the so-called peripheral countries. These countries had seen a steep deterioration in unit labor costs relative to Germany in the decade to 2008. So, and this is shown on this slide. But one can see that already the unit labor costs are falling quite a bit in these countries. And this development is even more pronounced if one takes into account that countries like Greece and Portugal and to a somewhat lesser extent Spain, they do not actually compete on the same markets as Germany. And if you correct for that, the improvement is actually even better than this. The other development that is taking place is the development is the deleveraging of banks, and we can see from the peak in 2007-8 that there is a steady decline in the leverage of banks, and this is a painful process, but it's a process that we have to work through, and well, progress is being made. So, and when we take these adjustments all together with the policy actions taken by individual nations and at the euro area level by the ECB, the upshot is that the immediate stress in financial markets has been reduced. I think it's a little bit outdated, but I think the picture is probably still broadly relevant. So here we see the development of the financing conditions. Well, very typical before Lehman, sovereigns borrowed more or less against the same rate in Europe. This was quite different, obviously, before the creation of the euro area, and then starting first in 2009. Spreads of a number of countries have increased quite dramatically, but over the past couple of months we have seen a decline in the spreads, which is a sign that at least some confidence is returning. And then here this chart tries to give some impression of this fiscal financial interdependence, and here one can see that the funding essentially what it shows in very simple terms is that the risk premia that banks have to pay on their lending is very highly correlated to the whatever the sovereign has to pay. And so one can have a very healthy bank, but if the sovereign is not healthy, then this bank will experience problems on the funding market. So also for this reason, it's very important that these elevated stress levels on the sovereign are reduced, because it would open up, and it has been opening up funding possibilities for the banks. So it is, as I said, very important to break this negative financial fiscal feedback loop, and some very big policy initiatives have been taken in this area. The ESM has been created. It was yesterday or the day before yesterday the court ruled that it was legal, so that was very good. Was a relief still for us. Then I think another very important development of the past couple of months has been the announcement by the ECB of this OMT program, so it's special monetary operations specifically aimed at improving the functioning of the monetary mechanism in countries that are under stress. And this certainly, I think, has helped to push down the spreads levels. And on top of that, the European Commission has come forward with on the 12th of September with a proposal to create a single supervisory mechanism, and to ensure that also in the future the banks are demonstrably in the best of health. But let me be very clear, there's absolutely no reason to be complacent, and there are still a lot of challenges ahead of us. But what is also clear is that there's still a very strong commitment, a political commitment to the euro area. And actually, this week, the leaders, or at least the ministers of finance, have demonstrated this again. This week we saw the conclusion of a long debate on Greece, and ministers of finance, they were in the end able to conclude on a package of measures to provide more breathing space for Greece. It's not a pretty package, but I think it's a good step. It gives a new perspective also to Greece, and what is important, it shows that politicians are prepared to face their parliaments on a number of very difficult issues, and it demonstrates still how deep the commitment is to the euro and to Europe. And that brings me to the main course of my talk today. So I think one could say that the political system is delivering a response to the crisis which goes more or less in the right direction. But it's also clear that the process has been far from efficient. Certainly in the eyes of market commentators, the response has often been too slow, we hear too little, too late. Announced measures have often failed to calm down the markets, or if they did, they returned very quickly. And in some occasions, policy initiatives which have been very well intended have come with very unintended but negative side effects. And in fact, one can see a recurrent pattern. Financial stress increases. This leads generally with some delay to additional policy commitments, either by national governments or on the European level. Initially, this has an effect. It reduces the financial stress. Well, then people seem to relax a little bit. Sometimes you see a little bit of backtracking on earlier commitments, or implementation is too slow. And then at some point the financial stress is building up again, and then basically the same process starts all over again. And from an economic point of view, this is clearly a suboptimal approach. It prolongs the period of uncertainty, and in doing so, it undermines growth, increasing the real cost of this crisis. But does this mean that these leaders are irrational? I don't think so. In fact, my thesis is that the European approach to the crisis can largely be explained in terms of policymakers acting rather rationally, but within pre-crisis governance structures of the EMU. To put it more starkly, I don't think the problem has been so much a lack of leadership, but simply an incomplete construction of the EMU. And I want to discuss with you in somewhat more detail some of the limitations of the pre-crisis construction. With the introduction of the euro, monetary policy has been fully transferred to the community level. However, responsibility for all other aspects of economic policy have largely been retained by the national level. This applies to fiscal policy. This applies also, very importantly in the context of this crisis, to policies relating to financial supervision and resolution. And what I've come to realize in the past couple of years is that in systemic crisis like the one we're facing today, the lines between these various policy areas become very blurred. They become blurred. And it is, in fact, the entire financial and economic system which is at risk. And in combating such a systemic crisis, all areas of macroeconomic policy, they have to work and they have to pull in the same direction. And this requires a high level of coordination, and that the fragmented pre-crisis governance structure of the EMU could simply not deliver overnight. So let's look at this in slightly more detail. The first point one has to realize is that national politicians respond to national constituencies, and this is only logical because they are essentially paid for that to do that. So, and one direct effect of this is that they have strong incentives to wait. And this can be observed both in vulnerable countries and in strong countries. The case is maybe the most apparent for vulnerable countries. If a country comes forward and asks for support, it's very clear to everybody that something has gone wrong. Moreover, these governments, they will realize that the money will not come free of conditions. So they will have to implement necessary but often painful reforms. And this generally doesn't help to get re-elected. So it's just not a very attractive proposition for an incumbent politician. So he has every incentive to wait. But also governments on the other side have an incentive to wait. Because as long as a crisis has not reached the country concerned, it's very difficult to convince your domestic audience that action need to be taken to avoid a collapse or to avoid disaster. So, again, also seen through the eyes of a politician of a strong country, of a surplus country in this respect, it may be attractive to wait a little bit until the financial stress increases, so that it's very apparent to everybody that something needs to be done. And in fact, the only institutions that have an incentive to wait, not to wait, but to act quickly, are those that have a mandate and a responsibility for the system as a whole. And, clearly, the European Commission is one of those, but in terms of money, there's very little that the European Commission can do. The other institution, obviously, is the ECB, and we have seen many times in the crisis that in the absence of quick actions by the nation states, it's in fact the ECB that is keeping the thing together. A second problem is what one could call a collective action problem. The leading doctrine underpinning the original construction of EMU was the so-called no bailout clause, as embedded in Article 125 of the EU Treaty. And the idea was that because markets knew that there would be no bailout, they would be cautious in extending credits to governments, and this would discipline governments, and hence there would be no crisis. This, at least, so we thought. In other words, this crisis was just not meant to happen. And the flip side of that is that at the euro area level, there were no governance structures and no instruments in place to deal with the crisis of this nature. And from personal experience, I recall very vividly that this posed a tremendous problem in the beginning of 2010. Because already from the fall 2009 onwards, it was very clear that things would go wrong in Greece, and even before we have had doubts. But it took actually until, I think it was early March 2010, before I actually got a task force was created, the Task Force for Coordinated Action, and I was appointed the chairman of this task force. So only in March we got the instructions to set up what has become the Greek Loan Facility Agreement. And then we had very little time, obviously, because I remember that I had to deliver my first report in 10 days. And basically, in May, there was the first disbursements under this Loan Facility Agreement. So this was what one could say a typical collective action problem. Now, I should also say that since then, things have improved dramatically. So governance structures have been, and coordinating structures have been improved. New institutions have been created. New instruments have been created. The existing institutions, they have received a broader mandate, and I think comparatively speaking, we're in a much better place now than we were in the beginning in 2010. A third problem was that the euro area did not have a pre-agreed burden-sharing agreement. An efficient resolution of any crisis typically requires a rapid recognition and allocation of losses. In the context of the euro area crisis, this was simply not possible, as there was no pre-agreed agreement and not an arbiter who could determine who would what the burden share would be. And this, I believe, has delayed very much the resolution of this crisis. And in a sense, negotiations that we have seen in the past couple of weeks on Greece, they evolve very much around this theme. So I would say one clear lesson for the future is if effective crisis resolution requires some ex-ante arrangement for how you're going to deal with the costs that arrive from a crisis and someone or an institution that can actually take decisions on this. Another point is the... A lot of discussions we've had on these points is the issue of moral hazard and hold-up problems. In the pre-crisis construction of EMU, the possibility to influence, let alone control from the outside, the economic policies of member states was very limited. And in the context of financial support, this poses a clear problem. Because it's very clear that whatever the economic policies that a country that is receiving support will follow, this will have a large bearing on the probability that this country is going to repay the support. So countries that provide support, they want to have some assurances on that. And again, this takes time to find out, to negotiate the right approach to this. And then as a last point, I would mention that also policymakers and certainly financial supervisors have been faced with a almost classic prisoner's dilemma. And I think if you would ask any one of the individual ministers, I think they would all agree that at least in theory, a cooperative approach to crisis resolution has to be preferred over a non-cooperative approach and is more efficient. But what if the behavior of the other parties to this game is difficult to observe? And one cannot be sure that these other parties, or in this case the other countries or the other supervisors, are playing the same cooperative game. And in such a situation, it may in fact be rational not to pursue this cooperative game yourself. And I think here banking supervision is a case in point. From a euro area stability perspective, it's clearly undesirable if all banks of surplus countries start simultaneously to reduce their exposures on deficit countries. However, if one is in doubt whether the banks of the other countries are going to stay in, it's quite rational for a micro-supervisor to instruct the banks to cut back on exposure on the vulnerable countries. But again, if all supervisors give these instructions, or maybe not official instructions, but let their banks know that it would be very nice if they would reduce their exposure, one can imagine that the aggregate effect of this can be quite dramatic. And I think this is exactly what we have seen, actually, and this is one of the reasons why the ECB had to come in with such massive liquidity support, basically to make up for the lending that was previously done by banks in surplus countries. So let me conclude. In dealing with this crisis, leaders had to navigate a large number of very complex political issues, and this has clearly stood in the way of a rapid and cost-efficient solution to this crisis. This is regrettable, but it should not have come as a surprise. In fact, if one takes into account all the political complexities, it's a small miracle that so much has been achieved in such a short period of time. And the reason for this is, again, politics. Because underneath the tough negotiating positions and the sometimes harsh rhetoric, the politicians on all sides have demonstrated a remarkable commitment to the euro and to European cooperation, anchored in the belief that we either row together or sink alone. Large quantities of support have been mobilized for countries in need. New institutions have been built. Governance structures have been adopted. Existing European institutions have been strengthened. And regardless of how one assesses these developments, I think it's clear that what we're seeing is a historical transformation of the euro area sector, and with that, of the whole European Union. And this process continues. On the 12th of September, I've mentioned already, the Commission has presented proposals for a single supervisory mechanism as a first crucial step towards the creation of a banking union. And I would say that the importance of this can hardly be overestimated. Yesterday, the Commission presented its blueprint for deep and genuine economic and monetary union. And it outlines the necessary steps to improve further on the EMU construction, while combining it with a realistic timetable. And the essence of all these proposals, starting with the six pack, so the strengthening of the Stability and Growth Pact, and ending with the proposals you can find in this blueprint, they all serve one purpose, and that is basically to fill the gap, to fill the inconsistency between, on the one hand, a fully integrated monetary policy, and on the other hand, fragmented macroeconomic policies. And given the nature of European politics, it's unlikely that we will get there in one straight line. But nevertheless, I'm quite confident that we will continue to make progress, step by step, and that in doing so, we will overcome this crisis and create a better, more stable, and more accountable economic and monetary union. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a very comprehensive and interesting presentation. My name is Stephanie Griffith-Jones from Columbia University. Thank you very much for this very interesting and very deep presentation. I do have one comment and one question. My brief comment is when you say, it's from a bit from a development perspective, if you say that there was no mechanism for burden sharing, if the international community had listened to the calls of developing countries after the East Asian crisis to have an orderly debt workout mechanism, then there would have been actually a ready mechanism. So I think one of the lessons has to be that in the future we have to have some kind of international mechanism. But my main comment was the following. I think you described very nicely all the progress that has been made, and I think it's very admirable. But on the other hand, the reality out there is that the macroeconomic performance of Europe is very bad. You have mentioned the word growth only once. And though the leaders took in June measures for growth, they haven't yet been implemented. For example, they gave a bigger role to the European Investment Bank. They said they would double the capital, just one example. And in fact, EIB lending has been falling quite sharply this year, including to small and medium enterprises, which are the ones that generate jobs. We have massive increases in continued massive increases in unemployment. GDP in Greece has fallen by 20%. I mean, public employee salaries in Greece have fallen between 30 and 35%. I mean, is that progress? I mean, so it has been done at the cost of growth. And I think the time is to shift from just focusing on crisis management, important as it is, but to growth, because growth itself will, in the end, deliver the solution to the debt problems of Europe. I mean, it's sort of simple arithmetic. Your debt to GDP ratios fall when your GDP rises, doesn't fall. So, where do you see progress along this growth curve? In fiscal policy, in monetary policy, where a lot has been done, but in other policies, credit creation, what will surplus countries like Germany do in terms of expanding fiscal policy, for example, or increasing their own wages, rather than putting all the burden on the debtor countries to cut wages? Thank you.
Okay. You raise a number of important points, and let me first on the EIB. And you're absolutely right that the EIB lending has been falling this year. I think it's important to understand the background of this. With the capital base that the EIB had, it was not possible to sustain the level of lending they were on. And this also had to do with changes in the rating methodology. So essentially, in order to preserve their own financial strength, they had to cut back on lending. And this was exactly why leaders decided to increase the capital base of the EIB to ensure that they can continue lending on more or less the same level as before. My understanding is that this will be agreed and implemented before the end of the year. But you're right, for the time being, this has not been done because it requires a ratification process and this takes a little bit of time. But this should be in place before the end of the year, as far as I know. Then on growth, I can only agree with you that ultimately what we need is growth. But one has to reflect also on under what circumstances growth can come about. And the problems we were facing last year was that there was a distinct fear that the euro, as we know it today, would no longer be there in a couple of months or a year or whatever time. As long as that fear is there, it's impossible for countries that are in what one calls the periphery to growth, because people will withdraw their money. This is exactly what has happened. Real interest rates will go through the roof. And there can be no growth in such a situation. So it's basically with a patient. If one has a serious accident, one first needs to stabilize the patient, and then after that, clearly one needs to rehabilitate. So I would certainly hope that. I think the concerns about the existential concerns, they have receded. For that, the ECB action has been very important, and I would hope that this provides the basis to work more on these other very important areas. Yeah.
Thank you. My name is Andrew Dean. I'm from the OECD, but I'm not going to ask a question about economics. The economics has been very difficult. I want to ask a question about the politics. And you've given a very frank and interesting discussion of the political situation. And I think there are a lot of people around, and this is just not economists, but it's the public, the financial markets, who have been very frustrated and very disappointed, and I'm sure that's also true in the Commission, that things as you described them always seem to be too little, too late. And you mentioned, well, step-by-step progress, but sometimes it seemed like two steps forward, one step back, or one step forward, two steps back even. And my question is a very political question, really, and that is, to what extent has the timing of key elections in key countries been important in slowing progress in getting agreement amongst the members of the euro area and the EU? And if you, I mean, two particular cases you talked about, both, as it were, the strong countries and the vulnerable countries. Obviously, a linchpin in a way has been Germany, because it's Germany that's the largest country in the euro area. And obviously, one reads all the time about such and such Länder election coming up and so on. And on the other hand, if one takes the case of, let's say, Spain, where there's been a lot of concern, there are regional elections that take place in Spain from time to time. The Prime Minister seems to have been a little bit reluctant to actually agree to a program. You know, there's been an issue which has seemed from the outside to be a question of pride or tactics. I'm not quite sure what. But to what extent do you think that the difficulties in the euro area have partly been that there are 17 countries that have to agree, and that there are elections happening all the time throughout the area?
Yeah. Well, the honest answer is that clearly this makes life more complicated for everybody. But again, this is I don't think it's unique for the euro area. I think if we look at across the ocean, there's a small issue with the fiscal cliff there, which could not be resolved before the elections, and hopefully will be resolved quickly afterwards. So yes, all these mechanisms they play a role. It's seen from the politician's perspective, this crisis is extremely annoying, because it doesn't fit in parliamentary calendars. So it's and it always pops up in times that you don't want it. And yes, this makes life difficult, and this complicates crisis management, obviously. But I would not say that it complicates to the extent that it becomes impossible. Because I mean, going back to 2010, this was there were all these rumors that and maybe right. I just don't know. I cannot. There were rumors that Angela Merkel at the time was trying to postpone the decision on Greece until after one of these regional elections. I can't remember which one, but in the end, a decision had to be taken right in the weekend of these regional elections. So it's often very hard to engineer, and until now, not a single politician, I think, has not taken decision if it was absolutely necessary. So that is yes.
Thank you. Alan Gilbert, UCL. Every financial crisis that I can think of since Latin America has, to some extent or other, been based on irresponsible lending by banks, both nationally and internationally. And then, having lent irresponsibly, and much of the investment not going into places that was supposed to go into, the banks have facilitated capital flight, which of course has worsened the situation. This has clearly been happening particularly badly in Greece at an international level. The Greeks haven't been paying taxes, the Swiss bank account scandal, etc. But it's also been happening throughout the region. My question, therefore, is, if banks are always responsible, in general terms, there are other causes too, of course, but if banks are at the heart of the financial crisis, if we talk about subprime in the States, Latin America, the Asian financial crisis, the euro crisis in Greece, what can be done to control these beasts. Because we're now trying to increase their capital base, but therefore they're not lending, which is leading to austerity. Now, I suppose my question is anything, can the EU and the Eurozone do anything about banks, given that banks are so much bigger than the EU?
Right.
So you've been relatively optimistic that things are getting better. Of course they are. But aren't we merely stirring up the next financial crisis, unless you can think of some nice way in which we can control the banks?
Yes. Well, this is also a very good question, but not an easy one to answer. I think one can go back much further than Argentina, actually, and I think also in the early 20th century or late 19th century, if at the heart of all these crises is an over is overcrediting. So controlling the credit cycle, we have been struggling with this for a very long time now. And I think what we have come to realize is that the whole approach of deregulation, less regulation on the banks, that I think has gone too far, and I think over the past years already, a lot of legislative initiatives have been taken to basically deregulate the financial sector. We have CDR4 proposal on the table, which would require banks to hold more capital, but there are regulations and directives and the negotiation on better regulating the shadow banking. Only recently the Liikanen report has been published, which suggests, and I'm not saying that we will follow necessarily this recipe, but this report suggests the separation of certain activities from other activities in banks. In the US we have the Volcker report, we have the Figures report here in London, so there's a lot of thinking going into that, but I must admit that it's not easy to get it right, and certainly not in the middle of the crisis, because on the one hand we want to avoid that these type of crises happen again, so for that we need more regulation, but at the same time one needs to be mindful that if one strengthens regulation very, very drastically in the middle of a financial crisis in which banks already have stopped lending, then one may overshoot. So it's I think very important to find the right balance there. But I think we have started this discussion, and we are. There are steps being taken, but we have not finished this discussion. I think this will be with us for quite some time. In this sense, I think maybe a last point about the scale of banks vis-à-vis the national sovereign. I think also this is for me one reason why we should bring this supervision and as far as I'm concerned, also resolution authority. At least to the euro area level, if not the EU level, but this may be a little bit difficult in this country, but certainly on the euro area level, because then there is a better balance between the scale or the scope of these banks on which they operate and the level at which these banks are actually supervised and controlled. But,
yeah.
Hi, thank you. Shapiro Zaltaloudis from University of Munster. Students of European integration have always been divided between two schools of thought, the intergovernmentalist camp and the neo-functional camp. The intergovernmentalists argue that if you want to understand the European Union, you have to see the preference of member states and how the government responds to electorate, what you said about these incentives to delay. And others argue, the neo-functionalists argue, that actually it's supranational leadership that also leads the way. And I was wondering, what's your opinion about this kind of divide? Can we say that the response to the crisis has been a government-led crisis, or also the Commission? You mentioned the ECB, but what about the Commission? Can the Commission influence current policy making? And that was, you know, you mentioned that the meetings have doubled of the European Council, and some would argue that actually this is a bad thing. The more the leaders meet, the more the governmental the EU becomes, and the less possible to get a proper European solution is. And also, I can mention some examples, for instance, Merkel attacking Barroso on the suggestion of Eurobonds. So I was wondering, what's your view on this debate between governments and EU supranationalism, and whether you can mention some examples where the EU institutions have actually contributed to the policy options available to member states? Thank you.
Two things on this. First, I don't think in this divide. Maybe because I've started on the government side and then moved to the European Commission. I think my personal view is that everybody has his role to play in Europe, and that we need to find a model in which these various actors work together in an efficient way. For this, it is necessary, I've come to that conclusion, that we move away from the peer pressure approach, which has been very prevalent in the coordination of economic policies. I think one of the lessons for me of this crisis is that this peer pressure doesn't work. So you need strong institutions, but they also need to be controlled. So I think it's more about finding the right balance and finding the right way to work together. And I would not, whether it's governmental or community based, that's I leave to others to decide or to describe. It's not something that interests me a lot. Can I mention examples of where the Commission has played an important role? The obvious thing to do would be to be modest, but it's very difficult on this side. But I would have given the same answer only a year ago when I was on the other side. There's hardly any policy initiative, whether it's been proposed by the Germans, the French, the Dutch, or the Italian, or whoever, that has not found its origins in analytical work that has been done in the European Commission. So all these initiatives, we have worked on all of them. And how it typically works is that if problems arrive, then we basically describe all the options that are open. This is often done in an informal way, so the outside world doesn't see it. But we write analytical papers outlining the options, presenting a menu to ministers or to national policy makers, and saying, well, we would advise this or that, but if you go that way, then this will likely be the consequences. So I think the role of the Commission, at least of the Commission services, has been a very important one, also in this crisis.
Okay, that's what we have time for. If you're interested to thank Martin for a very titled opening keynote speech. We have a coffee break now, and we come back at 11 o'clock. Thank you very much.